There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you and let you know we have a tremendous group coming with us tonight. We've got the Democratic leader in the Florida legislature, Mark Pafford, who will be discussing that recent special session and what the Republicans thought reform would be like. We're going to have Mohammed Malik from Students for Justice for Palestine discussing the ongoing peace search in Palestine and Israel. We've got the great progressive leader, Luis Cuevas, who will be joining us and giving us an update from his perspective on the electoral matters and progressive issues in general. And then also environmental journalist from DeSmog Blog, Stephen Horn, will be joining us. His news story is on the combination of fracking and oil and pipelines and what we need to be watching for next. And I have to tell you, I attended the conference over the weekend, the accountability conference, and it was really very interesting. A lot of very interesting people were there, and I'm going to play a couple quick excerpts of some of the people who spoke there. This is Edwin Enciso talking about the accountability conference.
So the purpose of the Accountability 2014 conference is to help grassroots organizers come together and share what their ideas are on the priorities for policy in this electoral season. One of the problems that we have as organizers is that we're pushing our priorities on our own. And one of the things that this conference does is it gives us the opportunity to say, well, let's say, for example, if my concern is immigration reform and your concern is women's issues, maybe there's an opportunity for you to share what you would like on a survey. I'll share what I want, and then we can put that together and do a survey together and have not only a greater reach, but my members can learn about women's issues and vice versa. When you do that with other movements like the environmental movement, the movement, labor movement, the power increases not only incrementally, it's exponential. And that's what we're trying to do.
So that was Edwin Enciso, and we've got a longer piece up on the website. Also, here's a statement by Reverend Russell Meyer, who was there talking about his perspective on the Accountability Project.
Okay, I'm Russell Meyer. I'm a faith leader, executive director of the Florida Council of Churches, and advocate for a number of justice issues across the state of Florida. I'm here today at the Accountability 2014 gathering in order to look at what kinds of ways we want to hold our political process accountable for the things that really matter to Floridians. And so in the room today are grassroots activists and organizers from across the state of Florida talking about the things that really matter to them out of their own heart, out of their own life's experiences, so that we might have a Florida political process that's based upon people's real lives rather than simply the commodification of financial instruments. And so as we gather here, the people who are here are very much passionate and they have a great sense of urgency about what needs to be done. And they together represent thousands thousands of Floridians, when you just look at the way their lives interconnect with lives of people in their family and communities back home. And so it's a small group that represents what really is the majority of Floridians everywhere. We have people of color, people of privilege, people of middle class, working class, all across the economic ladder, the cultural ladder, ethnic backgrounds, and etc. Coming together saying what binds us together is a Florida that works for all. And so we're working for that, and we want to hold our own political process accountable for our own needs and our own purposes for living well together. You too should be part of this movement. You too should be raising your voice and saying, I'm a Floridian, I should have the right, and I should exercise my responsibility to participate fully in our political life. Only when we all step up, wherever we are on the political spectrum, only when we all step up with the things that really matter to us, in our hearts, in the lives of our families. And not speak somebody else's speech, but speak from our own experience. When we put that in the political arena, we'll have a Florida that all can be proud of.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We also have a statement by Senator Soto, who's been very engaged in the fracking battle, and he gave a wonderful presentation, a very interesting speech, and this is just a highlight from that speech.
And so I asked if there was any indication there's any fracking or any fracking land or anything like that, and of course I got the response, oh, of course not, Senator. There's nothing going on there. What are you talking about? And even some right-wing organization said that I falsely claimed there was fracking. Oh, the justice. When about 2 or 3 weeks later, Danny Hughes Corp was found to be using some water pressurized fracking light procedures that were shattering the geology below. And they got caught. And they got caught in a big way, and it made the paper, and it was kind of a, usually it takes us decades, you know, to get some vindication. That was a couple weeks later we got a vindication. I could have wrote a script that fit better with the fact that our point was they didn't know what was going on and they didn't have control.
Okay. Now, this is a story from one of the great progressive online magazines, Reader's News, and they talk about how to speak to politicians about the issue of fracking. Several weeks ago, members of the group Concerned Citizens Ohio met with a state representative to discuss fracking, injection wells, pipelines, and natural gas industry in general. Here's something he learned about the meetings. If you want officials to take action, figure out how to put them on the spot. For example, when they met with township trustees about injection wells, they were pleasant, if slightly exasperated. The state controls all that. Our hands are tied, they assured us. Now, a heated exchange like that is not my idea of success. I'd much rather have them willing to work with us. They won't always be possible, though, and getting reluctant officials on record as being unwilling to even lift a finger is useful, too. If nothing else, it lets you know who you can count on. Either way, though, the idea is to bring officials something they have unquestioned authority to act on, and make sure to keep that something singular. With a multiple-part question or request, it's easy to pick the favorite one, address that, and ignore the rest. I don't think it's a good idea to leave wiggle room like that. Best to pick out the best available issue and stay on it. That approach seems to be best suited for a legislative session or other official meeting, though. At a town hall or an arranged date with a group, the best you can probably get is a promise to introduce something or a pledge to work on it. On the other hand, a more informal setting can be useful for what the heck are you people doing anyway type questions. And when it comes to fracking, Republicans are usually on board, while Democrats are equivocal allies at best. In Ohio, a handful of representatives have been good on the issue, but others are already cashing in, and the National Party is increasingly siding with the oil and gas industry. So approaching a Democratic office holder with an environmental or quality of life issue, no matter how heartfelt, no matter how sincerely expressed, is probably not going to accomplish much. The response will be, hey, different studies say different things, and anyway, look at the big picture. Things have really improved over the last few decades. The river never catches fire anymore, and unless there's some urgent problem happening, arguments about long-term risk and degradation will unfortunately not get much traction. It seems better to go right at the main pillar of their support on the issue, jobs and the economy. The right approach can put them on the spot. Here's an adapted version of my comments, as best I remember them, at a meeting with the state rep. Greetings, etc. admitted. Feel free to adapt them for any meeting you may have, and let me know if you have any thoughts on how to improve them. It really bothers me to see how timid Democrats have been on fracking. Anytime a Republican says jobs, Democrats dive under the table. But the promise of jobs is largely a mirage. Last summer, the Plain Dealer reported that employment had increased less than 1% since drilling began in eastern counties. In January, the Dispatch noted that the jobs just aren't there, and even in an industry that has started touting auxiliary economic activity instead, transients come into town when the infrastructure is being built, and they leave when it's done. The community has little to show for it. There's a temporary bump in sales receipts for restaurants and hotels and strip clubs, but no long-term benefit. It isn't like a steel mill that employs thousands of locals at a good wage over year after year and then supports ancillary businesses as well. Fracking has been going on here long enough for the results to be in. It doesn't create jobs in the way citizens would like to believe, and that should be a political or any office holder to say so. Democrats have the evidence to hit back and hit back hard on those claims. A handful of exceptions like Nikki Antonio and Bob Hagan have spoken out on the issue, but most have done a lot of shutting up, and it's enormously frustrating. Friends, let me bring on my first guest, Mr. Luis Cuevas, one of the finest progressives I know, a leader in this state. Luis, welcome, sir.
How are you, my friend?
Very good, brother. Very good. Yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you.
So tell me, of all these incredible stories and all the drum beating that's gone on this last week or so, what stories have you been following, sir?
So many of them. It's getting really hot from the events in Ferguson, the developments there, all the way to the case of our favorite Texan, Mr. Perry.
There were three things he wanted to talk about, and none of them were his indictment.
Yeah. Yeah, and oops, but it is just fascinating. It's been an incredible week in terms of having these developments. Many, too many tragedies, of course.
Yeah.
In the case of Ferguson, and been following that. And investigating a little bit deeper than what the media wants to, to do.
Sure.
One of the things that is interesting to look at is the fact that back in the year 2000, the population of Ferguson was 73% white. In 2010. The population of Ferguson was 67% black. That means the population flipped.
Yeah.
Over that period of time, from a white majority to a black majority. What did not flip was the political power.
And the police
stepped up. Yeah, I mean. But one of the things is, and what strikes me the most at this time is we have only heard from the police chief in Ferguson to this day. But Ferguson has a mayor, and it also has a six-member city commission, of which only one member is black. You see, 50s.
Yeah.
They have 57 police members for a town. I mean, almost 60 members, with only three of them black, for a population of 20-something thousand people. You can almost tell that there is a siege mentality
Sure.
going in there. You see, you can you have a population that is void of economic, even though they're in the majority, economic or political power whatsoever. And there is a big element of repression.
Yeah.
And when you come and put into things into play, as the events began to transpire, what you can almost see is this old style of doing things, which suddenly meets with a 21st century way of looking at things in terms of here they are accustomed to dealing with their members of the community in one way. They intend to keep on doing that, but they don't realize that there is a whole world community out there watching them, and where the news transpire faster than they can even think about what to do next. You see, to make things look their way.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is important to keep in focus is, in a large part of the progressive community, finally the issue of the militarization of the police is in sharp focus. And
yes,
I know many of us have been troubled for years. We've seen it increasingly on large-scale events, especially the conventions, where the American population is being treated like they treated Fallujah, like they treat third world peoples. And, you know, we really need to get this under control. The political process needs to address this. There is just no reason for these kind of weapons to be brought out for a civil protest.
Yeah, the only one way that you can think about that is if you want to repress and intimidate people. And in a situation in which you have a siege mentality already in place, you see, then they go out of their way to get all these things. And that's something else that hasn't been, you know, much made out of. And the fact is that the chief of police of that town was scheduled to go to Israel for an anti-terrorism training.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So you can see it. I mean, wait a minute. Why would somebody in a little town, most of the people are rural, outside of St. Louis, go all this way to go to Israel for terrorist training? And then you have all these people with all these weapons. You have this paramilitary institution out there. And, you know, it looked like right off the streets of Gaza.
Lewis, that brings something to mind. Maybe they were expecting to find tunnels under the city of...
I wonder what was up in there. But, that type of mentality, we have all this population that we need to keep under control. And by the way, that population has very few ways of communicating. They essentially don't have, I think they have a monthly paper there.
Jeez.
So that means that other than word of mouth and speaking to each other, they don't have any other, unless there's a tiny radio station or something like that there. But you see a population that is pretty much reduced to, old times. And sometimes I've been talking to people and said, well, don't you get, the feeling that somehow you can hear the sound of deliverance in the background, just because that's the way it is. It's such a repressive system where people don't have anything, or anywhere to go except there. And there is this, huge overreaction, which is, meant to instill fear on people. And it's not far from what the you know, the slave masters back in the old plantation days would do. It's, you know, the same type of mentality.
The other thing is that, you know, there's so many issues arise from this whole situation. You know, the police releasing a video of the purports to paint this young man, as a criminal. You know, I don't know who's running their PR boat there, but my goodness.
Yeah. that was the chief of police. Yeah, the chief of police made all those decisions, and even though he apparently was told by both the governor's office, the attorney general, not to do it. So you think of what ulterior motives were behind this. And obviously he was trying to change the focus from the shooting, you know, over to, well, it was justified because, you know, this was connected to a robbery, which, by the way, all the statements suggest that the policeman didn't know that there was anything connected to that.
Right.
So it was an independent situation from there in which he took action. And the question is, apparently there were multiple shots, and if the young man was shot from behind, you know, you have a very questionable case there.
And, you know, and then, of course, subplot 54, the officer was just recently touted as one of their lead officers in their police department. And hesitate to wonder what the rest of the bunch is like if he's a good guy.
I know. Yeah. But it all seems like this chief of police, it's coming up with all these things and has contradicted himself quite a bit. But in all this, you know, I still fail to see where the local authorities come out and say, let's hold a police chief, you know, up to, you know, his responsibilities. Let's call him on this. You got to answer to us. You got to explain to us. I haven't heard about that. What is happening there? I mean, who really rules that town?
Well, this is going to be an issue for months to come, because given the slow rate that information's trickled out of the, should we say, the proper authorities, I can't imagine they're going to be bringing this to trial quickly. And if they take it to another town to have the trial, This is going to be in the news through the election.
You bet. And one of the things that happened there was that the attorney general asked for another autopsy. So obviously, he's not looking in terms of we can trust these people in the first place.
Yeah,
to have done the right, you know, is that something is going on in there. And like I said, you know, this is all these people are accustomed to do this the way that they were done 50 years ago, and
you know,
trying to get away with it.
I haven't heard the right wing come out and say there's massive overreach by the governor and the feds, because clearly this has been made a state issue, and for probably the best of reasons, because clearly they had no clue what they were doing and they were just exacerbating the situation. But I'm afraid, on the positive side, maybe this will bring a couple issues into focus, and we can make some more progress on racial grounds and on this militarization of the police as well.
Oh, definitely, that has to be looked into. I mean, that is the failure of Congress to control this, because they actually, and we know, you know, back in the 60s, they used the dogs. And they used the water cannons,
right?
Back then, but as time passed on, they began to add more weapons and SWAT teams.
Yeah.
As it progressed, it has gotten to the point that they have these, vehicles that are meant for war zones. Then they have snipers on towers and these vehicles, they have sound bombs that they actually use. I mean, that they're deafening. They really hurt. They introduce solid wooden big pellets. That they fire at people, aside from the rubber bullets.
They call rubber bullets, right?
Yeah. But the rubber bullets they have, but this is an additional round, thick pellets made of wood that they fire onto the people. And, I mean, I saw photographs of people who have been hit with them. They were bleeding. You know, so it wasn't something just to scare people. And of course, on top of that, then you have the rest of the paraphernalia that they use for crowd control. So it was. And the other one thing is, if you take a look at the stance of the police confronting the people, it's almost like, you know, a taunting. Come over here, you know, bring it on. You know, it's that type of attitude, which is, you know, as Elizabeth Warren said, you know, America is not a war zone. You know, this is not the kind of thing we do. But it worries me that it's becoming the type of thing that so many people want to do in this country. You know, especially when we have population that, you know, and let me tell you one thing. Part of it, when we hear about all these people buying all these weapons, you know, the submachine guns. Yeah, all these things. A lot of them have been doing it because they have been looking at the state and local police militarizing.
Right.
And that's why they are reacting on it. And so it's a vicious cycle. And it's a vicious cycle that can have very, very dangerous consequences. In the end.
Later, I hope that we can talk about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Hopefully, we'll have those guests from the student group. And then also I'd like to talk with you about the Ukraine situation as well. Another very troubling one. Not to mention a return to Iraq.
It's a powder keg every which way you look. It's almost of it. It's been 100 years since World War I, and here we go again. You know, everything flaring up. We still have the Balkans unsettled. We have the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, later the British Empire, all fractioned up. From the historical perspective, you can see cause and consequences right at work.
And even Turkey, which is a relatively secular government, is turning more and more religious. And I can't remember if it was the president or premier who just won election again, is starting
Erdogan.
To pull out for what sect they are.
Yeah.
So he's introducing religion back into politics.
Yes. I mean, it is the one of these things that you can see how the politicians are have been manipulating religion for their political purposes. It all works in, and they have masses of people who are in upheaval. And one of the things that when you study Islamic history, you find is that there are cycles, as well as in American history, it happens with religion, that there are cycles in which you have uprisings by very orthodox groups who want to purify the system, and they have these uprisings, and before 1900, we had the Great Awakening in the United States, and then that was followed by there was a huge Protestant movement close to the Spanish-American War, and even through it, that was pushing the agenda, and they were pushing the political agenda of the day.
Luis, let me ask you to hold that thought. I've got
of course.
Representative Pather here. And,
excellent.
If you can stay with us, please do,
excellent.
And we'll bring you in the conversation, okay? Ladies and gentlemen,
thank
you. Welcome from the Florida Legislature, our good progressive Democrat, Mr. Mark Pather.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, sir. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, we
I'm
know
all ears.
Just, good. We know you just returned from Tallahassee. Please tell us how your take on that on how the legislature followed the good judge's instructions.
Well, you know, look, we were called up. It was pretty much quoted as saying it was a dog and pony show, which I feel it was. I don't think we accomplished much of anything actually in terms of what the judge asked us to do, which was to redraw some congressional lines for congressional maps. That we basically did in 2012. The judge, courts have been looking at this thing for 2 years, and they wanted us to basically draw maps that were fair and constitutional. I don't think we did that.
So do you expect the judge to reject this? Do you have any guesses on that?
Yeah, I would hope that's the case. We weren't involved in any of the meetings. I think what's interesting is a lot of people were wondering how the process works, and in this particular case, it was really a wonderful showcase of how the process works. the Republicans basically own the process. They're the majority in both chambers, and the governor, of course, is also part of that party, and they set up meetings. There were meetings that occurred, at least one of them, between the chair and the of the House and the chair of the Senate. They met on Tuesday night of Tuesday night, August 5th of last week, and never noticed anybody that they were meeting to basically draw lines. And, it's a significant event. Us in the minority, we're already at a disadvantage because we don't have the types of staff that a majority has. So when you double down on that by meeting in private and not inviting us to even discuss what type of maps are going to be considered, in my view, the process is as unconstitutional as it was in 2012.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Pafford. What about government in the sunshine? I thought that was a guiding principle of this great state.
Somebody on Facebook actually today was talking about this, and so many meetings, so many decisions are not in the sunshine. There's been stories of budgets that have been developed at the Waffle House a number of years ago. And it really is very problematic. We have laws that they say we should be operating and having meetings in the sunshine in public and make it available to the public. But so often, I think I said it on the House floor, it's kind of like an iceberg. I would say 75% of the nonsense that should be happening in the public happens privately, under the water, and outside of the public view of the sunshine. And that's a real problem. This process this past week only highlighted what we deal with generally anytime we're in any type of session. Again, we're at a disadvantage. And when you have that type of power as a majority, the Republican majority, you're going to want to keep that type of power by keeping us away from those very discussions. So it's a big problem.
Well, wouldn't that be something that the Attorney General, if she actually, was paying attention, should enforce? I mean, clearly, if the Constitution states that these things should be in the sunshine, and clearly if they're being done in the dark by a small group, clearly, you know, unconstitutional, but I guess it's not a crime in the conventional sense, and certainly our chief law enforcement officer is busy doing other things.
Well, you know, it is a crime locally, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, when you're doing the public business and spending public tax dollars, and you've had a very clear intent by previous legislatures and governors to do this type of work in the public, then it is an issue. You know, obviously, you know, in terms, as far as I'm concerned, I think Pam Bondi spent more time wasting tax dollars in the state than she has anything else. You know, she's been pursuing, you know, stopping providing health care and, you know, allowing people to get married versus doing real important things like perhaps, you know, ensuring that there's a democratic open process. You know, it's quite astonishing to me that she's in a race this year. Her, you know, it's the first type of attorney general that's been this bad, and she's just been atrocious. She could surely weigh in on this thing, but chooses not to.
Right. Let me ask you this. As you're in the legislative lull period now, even though there's no formal legislative activities besides this recent adventure, when do those preliminary meetings restart? Is it September, October, November, or
Yeah. Well, there's an answer to that. That answer is pretty much according to the Constitution. Obviously, we can – this same group of elected legislators before November 4th can meet in special session any time. And basically, you know, we can do the people's work at any time that either the governor or the president or the speaker call us to Tallahassee. And there are certainly a number of issues that they could call us there for, but I don't think we'll see that unless potentially this judge tells us to go back and redraw the lines. Under normal circumstances, if there is no special session, then we can expect after the election to be back on November 18th for something called organizational session, which basically ensures that all the chairmen and those type of folks are selected for committees. And as you can tell, I'm doing this in my front yard. The ice cream truck is going to come by. There you go. But
well,
just for the purposes of the interview, I'm going to stay seated, so keep going.
Okay, great. Let me ask Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push is with us tonight also. Luis, do you have a question you might want to put to our good legislator here?
Yes, I was. Good evening, Mr. Pafford.
Good evening. I'm happy I can impress you with our local ice cream man.
I was going to ask regarding this situation because it came up that apparently what the Republicans did in Tallahassee was to pretty much go over what they had before. You know, put it together with kind of Band-Aids and make it look like they had made a change, but it's not a change at all, really.
Yeah, that's correct. Look, I mean, so I stayed over the weekend prior to Monday's session, and there are a number of procedural issues that need to occur to pass a bill. And so the previous Friday, I believe it was the 8th, we had a committee meeting, and there was a bill that came forward. It's a proposed committee bill, PCB, and that was voted out of that committee. And, you know, the Democrats voted against it. Republicans voted for it. And then over the weekend, it kind of turned into a bill. Basically, whatever passed on Friday, they gave it a bill number. And then on Monday, we heard second reading, which is questions, and third reading, which is actual debate and then voting on the bill. What was curious to me is where the bill came from. And what we found out was, you know, the bill basically was filed, a bill, a Senate bill was filed on August 5th, and it was basically turned into a PCB, which is that proposed committee bill, by the House on Thursday afternoon, and then we were listening to that bill on Friday. There was the only people that had ever seen that bill in draft form were the Republicans. And, you know, what was fascinating to me, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, you probably have, but if you go into a Word document, if you click on the right mouse, you know, switch button, you'll pull up something called properties. And if you go into the properties, you can basically see how and when a document was created, a state stamp.
Right.
And so the Speaker of the House on the floor, and this is all out there, it's all public tape, so anybody listening to this, you should watch it. I asked the Speaker, you know, when he made it to Tallahassee and started working on the maps, and he said he heard about special session on August 4th, drove on August 5th to get to Tallahassee, and then began having these meetings the evening of August 5th with Senator Galvano. Well, once I checked the properties of the bill that was filed, the bill was filed on August 5th, not after they had met during the evening, but on noon of that day. And so, you know, obviously, you know, there was far more going on than what they had shared. And, you know, it's a bad situation. It's something that shouldn't occur, but, you know, Amendments 5 and 6 were not, you know, adhered to.
It's beyond the pale that they can do this type of thing. You know, it's obviously the arrogance of power that they have. You know, they definitely don't care what the public has to say about this because they have the power.
That's correct.
And the other thing that bothers me is that we don't have a inquisitive press that goes in there and look at these things. They just expect to be given the results. This is the end result that we got, and they don't ask any questions how you got there, or you know, question the documents themselves.
Well, and you know, here. Yeah, I'll be one of the few politicians that stand up for the press, so you can write this down. The problem is this. The press, first of all, there are not as many of them as there were 20, 30 years ago. But the problem is they do ask the questions. It's the arrogance of the individuals they ask. You know, they're basically lied to. They don't have many of the resources that they used to have. And generally speaking, you know, for them to find a meeting that's going on potentially at somebody's home dealing with state business or, as I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, a Waffle House, you know, it's very, very difficult for them to put a story together these days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I suspect if we had a different governor or a different president or speaker, you know, any one of those three, that was different in terms of their party affiliation, there might be some leverage to help everybody get that.
Right.
But right now they run the whole show, and that's what it is,
right.
It's a show.
And we don't have an attorney general who looks after the interests of the people of Florida. The attorney general looks after the interests of the governor of the state.
Well, she looks at the interest of the largest corporation. She looks at the interest of those who want the wealth. She wants to protect the governor who, as far as I'm concerned, is the worst governor, not only in modern history, but I've said going back to the to Reconstruction. You know, this guy, unfortunately, has turned back Florida 50 to 100 years. His policies have been ill-conceived. The ignorance and sheer carelessness at which he has, you know, made decisions should be shocking to every Floridian.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, because I haven't seen this coming out of the Democratic Party, that, coming out after what is going on in Tallahassee and throughout the state. But in looking back in time, the Republicans began to take control of the House back, I think it was 1992, and then began to progress since then in taking over Tallahassee, the governorship. But they are continuously running against the Democrats and blaming the Democrats for everything that has been happening since 1992 and high taxes. But who has been in control all that time is these guys. Somehow it never hits them back.
Yeah, and it's hard to. I say it all the time. I've been saying it forever. You know, I've been elected 6 years, and every time I've had an opportunity to speak over the 6 years, I've made the case that, you know, they're arguing against themselves, because generally if they have a problem, they've created it. You know, we've had nothing to do with these issues. And so, you know, there's some difficulty there. I do think there is messaging that should be part of what we do. The bad part in terms of being in the type of situation that we're in, which is basically a minority that hardly has to exist. I think we need to be stronger in terms of the language we use, because the money is not going to be there to help us echo it. Yes.
A question I have for you is, I see from a news story that there was a Democratic map that was proposed and voted down. Who was involved in that creation? And I was wondering if, was there any honest consideration given of it?
No. Yeah, it's a great question. So Senator Darren Soto and his staff person, Christine, they decided they would try to draw a map, and basically, I decided that maybe we should take a look at that map, since we don't have the staff, as I said, to do these things ourselves. Let's take a Senate map, and we'll offer it as an amendment. And all this was done, you know, in the sunshine. There were only two people involved in drawing that map, and it was Darren Soto and his staff. They filed the bill. Once they filed it, we were able to, you know, use the bill as an amendment on that Friday previous to session. During the Friday session, what was fascinating is the staff that had drawn the PCB, which is essentially the Republican bill, they didn't have time to analyze our bill, our amendment to their bill. The only time that they really spent on that amendment in terms of analyzing it was analyzing it in terms of it being a bad bill. And what they did, which was fascinating, they used a standard on that bill that they did not use on the PCB to make it look like it was a bad bill.
Oh, my.
So they used the Kendrick Meek Kendrick Meek election performance numbers, which, as far as we were concerned, were thrown off, because you had, you know, a very, very well-known independent, i.e. Charlie Crist at that time. You had Kendrick, and then you had, you know, Marco Rubio. And so we basically said, wait a minute, you know, you're using a system here. Did you use it against your bill? And they said no. And I thought that was really incredible that they had taken time not to analyze their own bill. They used a different standard entirely. But again, you know, when you're in power, you are able to do certain things. And, you know, I said this on the floor, you know, the minority in this state, the minority caucuses, it's a very strange dance in terms of how we exist in the minority with the numbers that we have. And we essentially depend upon an honest, open system, so at least we have at the end of the day an opportunity to be part of whatever decisions are going to be made. Now, that requires tremendous responsibility on behalf of the majority. Well, obviously, they've decided not to, you know, allow that type of input, and they've basically shut down the minority, which, you know, there's great responsibility and care to make sure that that occurs. They don't care.
You know, another question I was going to ask you is, I understand right now the constraints that our good progressive Democrats are under in our legislature. I was wondering, is there any attempt by the party to kind of bring state level resources together to really beat the drum for this election, to get people to come out for the primaries in August 26th? And of course, you know, I've never seen sort of a united Democratic front to say, without real participation from the Democratic majority of Florida, we're going to continue to be suffering from a Republican legislature.
Yeah, and the awful reality of that is this. You know, you've seen it in the governor's race. You know, Rick Scott's going to have $100 million. Whoever it is in the nominee coming out of the Democratic election, they're going to have far, far less dollars. But that's a problem that, you know, every minority has. Generally speaking, if you're large corporations, in this case, you know, if you're the Republicans, you're depending on huge dollars to get your messages out. And you're using every one of those dollars to basically win seats and also win a governor's race. When you're a minority, dollars just do not funnel in any reasonably proportionate amount. And so, you know, the spending is going to be basically trying to identify our candidates to make sure that people know who they are in those seats, maintaining a House that has, and a Senate that has a more than 30%, and then throwing everything else you can into the governor's races. You know, it's not a, with Citizens United mentality, the situation is far worse than it's ever been. And sadly, there's a lot of people out there that are persuaded by mail campaigns and television ads, and that's how people win races. It's not as much grassroots as much as it is spending huge dollars in advertising markets.
Go ahead, Luis.
I mean, that's just the horrible, that's the horrible truth, and that's what we need to deal with.
Yes. I was wondering in terms of looking at the number of challenges that we have to the Republicans, and many seats that are actually being uncontested, you know, that they're actually giving Republicans a pass to the point that they continue to have, they don't have a super majority, but they have a serious majority there. I mean, they could amend the Constitution maybe of the state, if they set their minds to do it. But the question is what is the problem of getting more candidates to run in there? Is the party having a problem with that? I know there is the issue of the money always, because it's so expensive to run a campaign, particularly with the money from corporations, but I don't see the challenges, and it goes from the state house to the state senate, and then it gets even worse with the congressional Florida congressional representation, that we have fewer and fewer candidates in there.
There's an answer for that too, and you know, it's loaded. First of all, you know, generally speaking, at this point, incumbents always have an added advantage by being incumbents. Now,
right.
after the quote-unquote, God, what did they call it, the reform, the election reform that occurred, you know, last year, now candidates can roll over, I think it's $20,000 immediately into their accounts. Now, so you couple that with what I would say, you know, it's a moderate fee to qualify of about $1,700 to $1,800 for a House seat, and I believe it's more for a Senate seat. You basically, if there were enough money, which there isn't, to find these candidates and get them qualified, that would be step number one. That could be easily, you know, $100,000. If you look at the dollars that we bring in, and you know, this is not inside ball, but basically we've got 45 members of the House caucus. I'm the incoming leader, and my job is to make sure that we get, you know, 45 people coming back.
Okay.
I would love 60, I would love 70, but the way the districts are drawn, there's very little opportunity for you know, those pickups. With the dollars that are out there, we really have to concentrate on the races that, you know, are most critical. And we don't want to see that slippage going in where we lose the, you know, the super minority, I guess, where we become the super minority again. So much of this has to do with money, you know, and that's why it's going to be important, you know, changing the governor, because I think then we might be able to begin having some sort of benefit in terms of added dollars that we can raise, but also hopefully some policies that we actually can all get behind.
Let me ask you, if I may, because I've looked at this in terms of how the Republicans played their cards over a period of time, and maybe you know, and I'm talking, you know, I'm asking so that the listeners can get a grasp. And you've been doing a great job of explaining this in layman terms, that they can get the picture. You know, in the local elections, how important is that to get, you know, more and more people at the local level to get involved, vote, get their get the school boards, city commissions, county commissions. All those that, you know, that over time make a framework so that eventually it gives you support at the point at which you are working. So that means that if you have a body of support behind you, that can make it more effective for you to not only to get elected, but to also get, you know, what you want to move.
Well, and what you mentioned is really critical. I mean, what I've explained, you know, and by the way, you know, the party has some very, very intelligent, smart political people, very good people. I would say that. But as you, I think what you've inferred is there's work for all of us, and that work really begins at the local level. You know, whether it's you at home listening who happens to feel that the decisions that, you know, people in the legislature make are bad, or at your city hall, or at your county commission, you know, that's where all of this starts, building that larger base and building it with people who are going to be very good candidates for future races. I mean, if, in fact, Scott loses, we're going to have a very good base, a bench, if you will, of people to be able to go to win these future races. So what you say is exactly what we need to be doing. All of us have that responsibility.
Mark, you want to leave us with any final remarks, sir?
Other than I missed the ice cream, which was good because I'm diabetic, and the mosquitoes are chewing me up. We had tremendous rain yesterday, but I always appreciate being able to come on. I love the questions and the time that you offer. It's always quite easy to do this, and I think this is probably the best connection I've ever had.
Well, we certainly are very happy to have you, sir. We appreciate your political insights and the fine efforts you give for us good progressives out there. So thanks so much. We're so glad you could join us.
Yes. Thank you very much.
You guys take care. My pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Representative Mark Pafford, one of the finest progressive legislators we have right now. Louise, What's your takeaway from this discussion? You know, once again, we're ill-served by a Republican legislature. I think if that judge is in any way interested in actually trying to help the situation, he's going to have to call it back.
Yes, definitely. It's not a matter. I would take it. If it were that judge, I would take that as an affront. Somebody who's trying to make a fool out of me by doing this type of thing. I mean, wait a minute, you know, we've been through this before. You're throwing this back at me. Okay, now this is what we're going to do. The question is whether the judge is going to say, well, there's going to be a special election then. We're going to draw that map. Why wasn't the judge involved in looking at it? I know that they have a bunch of stuff to do, very limited budgets to work with, which is a problem in Republican states for officials to do their job. But the judge has a certain amount of authority that he can actually come out and say, you know, this is an outrage what you're doing. It's an insult to the court. And many of these individuals are actually attorneys. So as such, they are officers of the court, and they're bound to respect the court, and if I were a judge, I would hold them in contempt for doing that. But I'm not.
Well,
but,
thank goodness for women voters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that there's all these organizations that need to begin to really get people out there and say, wait a minute, we know what you're doing, we know how you're doing it. And we're not going to let you get away with it. It's almost sometimes like watching paint dry. and you say, oh, my God, if we had the resources to do this. But, I think that overall, we all on this side of the aisle need to do a little bit more cooperation with each other and work together in mass. It's a matter of getting people, registered to vote and ready to vote and get their IDs, their photo IDs, because that's at the crux of the problem here for many of these things. And then, cooperate in strategies that eventually will lead to, getting what we want. What we want eventually is to have a nonpartisan board to do redistricting of the congressional districts in Florida. We used to have that. And for many years, it worked fine until somehow, I don't know who the Democrats were who said, okay, we can go back to partisan. Say, what on earth did you do this for? And you have a state in which the Democrats actually have a majority of voters if they voted. But all these things combined means that, hey, let's take a second look back and see, look at the big picture and see where we are at and where on earth are we going with this. If we're going to continue on this trend, and obviously, the other one thing is that somehow, we are getting lost in the process of electing people. And here we go again. We had a really split up situation, as we had with the senatorship back a few years ago, and here we are with the governorship all over again. That means that there is a certain lack of a certain strategy to be played. And I would like to see some changes there. But, talking to people on the street, they don't get it. They don't see what's going on. They don't know what's happening. I ask people, who do you know where the local Democratic Party is? They don't have a clue. I ask them, do you know what the DEC, Democratic Executive Committee? They say, what's that? I said, that's a party, the county party. I said, no, we don't know. They don't have a picture. They don't have an idea. And then, there is no participation in part of the grassroots in electing who their candidates are. Somehow they pop up, but they're not asked. Say, okay, you vote for these guys. And they don't have somebody. And, I'm afraid to say, I know I'm going to insult some people, because we are in North Florida, we have a situation like that, where in the Florida, I think it's the Congressional District 2, where Gwen Graham, the daughter of Bob Graham, is running for the U.S. Senate. But, she is running as a, let me see, the term, well, they now use the term New Democrat. We used to call them Blue Dogs before. Yeah. And that's what's going up. And then, many people just stay home and they don't vote. Because what they're going to get is, they know it's the same vote for the same thing. In the end, the voting record. So they know who, who's what, and they stick with that. I would like to see a change in that, but obviously it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a long time. And so we have too many complications here that actually confuse the voter, and we have to clarify that. We need to simplify things so that the voters can actually see and understand what is going on. They don't have the time to go about reading about these things, and finding all the information. The vast majority of the people who don't vote don't do so, 60% of them, because they're too busy to vote. That's a horrible excuse, but that's what happens. They're too busy making a living. And many of these people don't even get the newspaper. They don't read the newspaper on a day because, they go in the morning, get the kids out to school, get themselves to work, come back in the evening. Maybe they turn on the TV for the 6 o'clock news. Maybe. Some don't. And, that's the perception that they have of the world outside. And somehow, when we have middle class and upper class politicians looking at these things, they fail to see what's out there. The realities of the average voter, of the working class man or woman out there. And we need to work on that. And I think progressives have a lot of work still to do there.
Luis, let me
yes.
Let me turn to an international front. It looks like our
yes.
Our guest to talk about the Mideast is delayed. Let me
okay.
play a short segment as a way
All
of
right.
leading to another topic. This is a little tape recording that I'm sure you'll remember.
Electron here.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleet should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think Well, in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this. I think
Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call, but you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, the 3+1 conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I mean, that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got, and he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written... Oh, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah,
okay.
I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And, again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why...
This is the dark side of nation building, I think, Luis.
Yes.
And
amazing.
Like our good ambassador said, hey, fuck the EU, right?
Yeah. One of the things that happens in behind the closed doors, which most everything does, you can see how the destiny of nations essentially is carved out by people. And in this picture, you know, one of the things that I've been looking at and I've been contacting other folks about it is that essentially the role of the plutocracy in this has not been looked at. You see, let me put it this term, it's plain old banksterism at work. You see, and here is where the EU comes into the picture, because all that the EU wants to do is actually, bankroll and support the banksters. That's exactly, and the whole picture of austerity is what they've been doing. And then they've been pushing that in Eastern Europe. And then they've been looking at, essentially over a period of time, pushing this closer and closer to the Russian border. And there's nothing more challenging, if not, let me put it this way, upsetting to the Russian people than having foreign forces, whatever they might be, close to their borders. They've been invaded more than enough times in the last 100 years to have this potential coming closer and closer to them. They're not happy with that. The Russians first of all, have this phobia, this fear of foreign intervention. They also have this feeling that they're never being respected by the European countries. They're not even treated as Europeans. They're almost like, well, you know, you're not Asians, but you're not Europeans. You're Russians. And while in terms of the, you know, what you call it, the relationship between states, that might not show up that easily. It does when a ruler wants to get the support of his people. And here is where you can see Putin manipulating the Russians. Is by saying, hey, we have a foreign threat. You see, Mother Russia is being threatened. And here I am, you know, doing this to stop it. You see, they have to repent.
You're totally right. It plays into Putin's hands by being a clear threat to them.
Yeah.
We had promised Gorbachev that we wouldn't try to NATO-ize that ring of nations around them. It was part of the Warsaw Pact. And here we are, right? I mean, my God, Kiev was part of ancient Russia for centuries.
Yes. Yes. You know, the Crimea was a vacationing place of the Tsars. Yeah.
You know, that we would support neo-Nazis, you know, not to mention, you know, this incredible, you know, corruptive attack on national sovereignty. There's just no prettier word for it. That's all it is.
Yep.
And, you know, in my worst moments, I'm afraid that jet being blown up was just for distraction purposes. We're no longer talking about the fact that, let's see, A, we talked about suborning the government, B, the government suborned, C, look at the shiny object. The plane's been blown up. Because, frankly, from everything that I've heard about the rebels, they're the gang that can't shoot straight. Other than a sprinkling of Russian mercenaries, they can't do anything.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there is this one-sided view of what is happening there. We don't hear the other side. You know, there's absolutely no view. There's no access. And somehow those voices are not coming through here. And if they filter, then it's propaganda. But what we got over on this side is not propaganda. But the problem is, who are these people doing this on behalf of? And it's not, you know, the best interest of the people in all these countries. It is to a global corporate, body that is now introducing all these treaties. Mean to actually curtail governmental, you know, the different countries' governmental authority over corporations, so that actually corporations can veto any governmental action. Is what these treaties are doing.
Right, and they don't have to even pay lip service to any kind of constitutional rights because the corporation exists in and of for itself.
Exactly. So it's the global corporate state. You know, all these years, the Republicans have been bitching against the United Nations because, you know, the United Nations want a government over the world. And here we are having, you know, the global corporate state dawning upon us.
And they're all looking the other way. Who would have guessed?
Yeah. It's just amazing how this keeps happening, and here we see now recently Canada, the Harper Petro State, trying to make a deal with the European Community, and the Germans coming back and then saying, hey, wait, we don't want to have a corporation say no to our laws. You know, we don't want this. So that is a very iffy situation right now there. Of course, the European Union, well, they, you know, they're headed by the corporations anyway, and the the World Bank and the IMF, they are the ones who are, you know, pushing these things.
While we're over on the continent over there, let's go a little south. Boy, arming those Syrian rebels has certainly done good things for us, huh?
Whew. I want, you know, suddenly...
slow learners,
you know.
You know.
Yeah, well, when Grumpy McCain went over there, you know, to pose with all these
right.
folks, yeah, and it suddenly happens that they were the ISIS people all that time. We armed those people, and so it's now coming back to bite us in the butt.
Yep. Especially
yeah,
when they're trying to get those oil fields in northern Iraq, huh?
Yeah, well, there's plenty of oil fields out to be taken out there, and so here is what is happening: that we have several nations playing proxy games
right.
in the region. Sometimes, you know, the worst offender is Saudi Arabia. They are behind every machination out there. And then Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, they have the money and the influence. They manipulate everything as much as they can. And they have some of the most offensive governments and repressive governments, too. And, you know, we always look the other way when it comes to them.
Well, they're our allies.
Yes.
Germans still torture and subjugate women. But then again, so do we.
Yeah, exactly. And George used to, you know, hold hands with the Saudi Arabian king.
Heartwarming, wasn't it?
Yeah, man. This is the guy who looked into Putin's eyes and saw his heart. I mean, oh, God, you look at these things and you say, you know, I mean, are we for real? You know, what is going on? But amazingly, it's the situations that we are seeing here. I wonder, I have, you know, with that ISIS state situation, I wonder how much of this is the Syrian state behind. Because you have very well-trained, very well-armed. These are not people coming from 500, you know, miles away these are trained military men. These are people who know what they're doing, how to do it. They have a plan. They have strategies. And so... what's behind all that? And the fact that we don't know, nobody tells us. Oh, they want to make it an Al-Qaeda 3.0. It's going back to the mentality of, if you remember, the man from U.N.C.L.E.
Sure.
And we're thinking about these powers that were out there, that were equivalent to the power of the world, Rush.
Mm-hmm.
And thrush and all these things, you know, and and you know, when you say, wait a minute, can you compare these to the same thing? No, but we let the media do that, and now you have, you know, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Oh, they're going to be in the streets of London, you know, if we don't stop them.
Yeah, I heard
know,
Richard Haas this morning saying that. This is not a regional problem. This is an international problem. They're our enemies. They're attacking here.
Exactly. I mean, and so we need to repress our people even more. That's pretty far away right now, and they're quite busy. And, you know, they need to operate on budgets because money doesn't quite come quite that easy. After what they have to do. But we have a whole, you know, industry based on all that those fears that actually are pushing us around and telling us, you know, you've got to be, you know, on your guard and you're going to follow us and listen to us and do what we tell you to do. But it makes absolutely no sense that you would have this massive number of people whose numbers nobody knows, because nobody has said what is the strength of these people. You know, they pretend to create a state, a caliphate of their own, carved within the ancient caliphate of Baghdad and Syria, which are two different caliphates back in Muslim history, the Islamic history. And they're going to go and move from Syria through the territory of Iraq, and they're going to carve a state of their own there. Now, that's a ploy that goes way back, you know, when you think of it, to the 19th century, or maybe the 18th century, or the 17th century. But in the 21st century, you begin to question what is going on here, you see. And the truth is that there might be an attempt there to, you know, to create a state within states, but in fact, Iraq is partitioned for all real purposes. There's no more Iraq, any, you know, at all. Iraq is Sunni, is Shiite, and is the Kurds. Now that's what you get there. It's going back to the old boundaries before the British broke through there after they beat, you know, the World War II and the World War I ended the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, and all that. So, you know, with that in mind, you know, see, you question who's there, there's some element behind all that. The Saudis support the Sunnis. And Iranians support the Shiites. What gives? Who is in between? Who's getting in there? What is the, you know, the purpose of all these things? In a Machiavellian way, you can actually come up with a soap opera view of here is Putin actually sending masses of soldiers into Syria who go up through, you know, to conquer Iraq by way of Syria, and they create the state there, which is preposterous, but, you know, the mind reels is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you know, there's another way to look at the game, too. As long as Saudi's enemies are all at war with each other, in other words,
yeah,
all the local powers are engaged, and, of course, they're all evidently fully ignoring the devastation being wrecked on Gaza. So they're seeming to be enjoying this engagement. It's just appalling how many people are being just destroyed.
Exactly.
You know, for political games purposes, it's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. The sacrifice of human lives is amazing. You know, what is happening in Gaza, what has been happening in Gaza for forever now, it's exacting generations of people. I mean, it's just the devastation is incredible. I had a student of mine who actually worked in that region. He studied foreign relations. He actually tried to get into the State Department, and you know, initially was rejected. They called him back. He said, "Then no, I don't like their politics." At that time, it was Bush had gotten in, and so he went to work for an NGO. He was actually the country director for that area there, the Palestine. And actually, he lived across the street from Arafat.
Wow.
And we had conversations of what was going on in here, in there. It was, you know, I heard from him before any of these things about the yellow cake, thing with Iraq. Actually, you know, the whole thing was, you know, through an Italian second-hand, plan, and it was a no good. I got the word from him, don't believe this. He said, there's nothing there. This is a setup. Unfortunately, the young man passed away, and not before he was country director for Iraq, and he lived with the Kurds. But apparently in those trips over there, he got a bacterial infection and passed away at a very young age. He was still in his 20s.
Wow, that's too bad.
But it was, you know, it was shocking because he was an incredibly bright young man. But his view of what was happening in there and the Israeli situation, the fact that, you know, what he saw was Israel has absolutely no interest in peace. They want to throw these people out in the sea. You know, they want to push it all the way as far as they can. Either they become a colony, a colonized state, or else they have to go somewhere else.
Luis, my final guest of the evening just showed up.
Excellent.
I'd like to welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Steve Horn of Dismog Blog.
Yes.
Steve, welcome.
Good to be back, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, sir. I also got Luis Cuevas with us from Progressive Push. He'll throw some questions at you, too. Steve, you've been following these the fracking and the oil issues for a while now. You've got a great depth of understanding. Why don't you talk about your latest article, sir?
The latest article is about what I call the clone to the Keystone XL pipeline that very few people are talking about. It's the combination of Enbridge's Alberta Clipper pipeline, Enbridge's Flanagan South pipeline, and Enbridge's Seaway Twin pipeline. And those pipelines together go from Alberta, where the tar sands are in Canada, down to the Gulf of Mexico, down in Port Arthur, Texas. And that's actually what as listeners probably know, it's the Keystone XL pipeline does. And so this entire pipeline system will officially open for business in October 2014 this year. And that was just announced on their investor call. Obviously, it's kind of been public knowledge if you've looked into these issues that it was going to be built. But the official month is October of this year. And so it's important. It means that a lot of this tar sands oil is going to be getting down to the Gulf this year, which is, of course, months before the Obama administration will make a final call on the Keystone XL northern half, which runs from Alberta to Cushing, Oklahoma. And so way ahead of that decision, we already have a pipeline system that's doing what Keystone XL is supposed to do, and that's bringing that tar sands oil down to the Gulf. And so it's one other key thing to note is, didn't get much publicity, but almost 5 years ago today, President Obama gave the green light for the Alberta Clipper pipeline, that first one I mentioned. That one runs from Alberta down to Flanagan, Illinois. And so that was on August 20th, 2009, during congressional recess. So almost 5 years ago today. And so that was sort of the first, the first frontier for Enbridge to create its own Keystone XL clone. And now the second and third phases of that, the Flanagan South, which runs from Flanagan, Illinois, down to Cushing, and then the Seaway Twin, which runs from Cushing, Oklahoma, down to Port Arthur. Those will be conjoined together by October of this year. And so it's a big deal for the industry. It's a big deal for climate change reasons.
Another interesting aspect of that new article also was you were talking about the fact that they're also going to be using their railway component as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's another key development that the tar sands marketers are without the Keystone XL and without some other key pipelines in Canada that they're still waiting for approval on. They've been moving towards what's already happening with the Bakken fracked oil in North Dakota, and that's moving towards moving that stuff on rail. And so Enbridge itself is thinking about building an offloading facility in Flanagan, Illinois, where that Flanagan South pipeline starts, and moving a lot of that oil from Flanagan down straight to the Gulf, like 160,000 barrels a day is the capacity to, at least to offload it to rail. So that's another, that isn't a, you know, it's a lot of barrels a day, 160,000 on top of those pipelines, which are between 600,000 and 700,000 barrels a day. So if you just do the math, that's about the same as what Keystone XL is, and that's supposed to be, when it's fully built, the fourth phase, that northern half of the pipeline, that's also supposed to be 700,000, 800,000 barrels. So, yeah, that's another key development that too few people are paying attention to, except for if you're reading those investor calls, you see kind of they're talking about it pretty openly to themselves in the industry, although to the public they're still talking as if the Keystone XL is the end-all, be-all.
It amazes me that you've been so effective scooping this information, because I've heard no mention of this other pipeline at all.
Well, yeah, it's almost never covered in any media. I should say not the mainstream media, not the progressive media.
Should I congratulate you now? That Pulitzer shouldn't be that far away.
yeah, but you know, it's covered in very closely in the investor media and in the business media and oil and gas industry media, and so that's the main way. I just read their press. It's not really, seems like an unconventional way to get the news, but they are very open about the pipelines and stuff when they're, you know, for the media among themselves. Then when they speak to the public in commercials, they all act as if Keystone XL is the only thing that matters. And then on the other hand, these other pipelines are getting built. And so, I think it's important to pay attention to the business media, because it is, the pure business media is actually not really propaganda. It's pretty objective, because people are trying to make money. You know, it's supposed to be actionable intelligence for investors.
Luis, do you have a question for Steve?
Yeah. Hello, Steve. One of the things I was looking at, and the smog has a Canada section for when you, in your blog,
mm-hmm.
And you cover a lot of what is happening up there, and it looks like from what I've been reading that, you know, the Canadian oil schemes are getting riskier and riskier in terms of investment and what they can get out. Is that true they might not get exactly what they want, or is that a ruse as they are looking into the Atlantic and getting into those ports out there and exploiting, you know, the oil fields over there and then using it to sell it to Europe over time? It's a big jump right there, but I would like to, you know, get your thoughts about that.
So you're asking about sort of moving the tar sands oil eastward towards the Atlantic?
Well, what do you call it? The flow of that oil, the tar sands,
mm-hmm.
oil, as they're looking to go eastward too, not just down the pipeline, which, you know, the Keystone is already pretty much at work in many sections of it. But, you know,
they're
looking at also going out east and west, because they're looking also at going over to the Pacific, in this petrostate,
spill in so many directions.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying now. Yeah, so in Canada, I mean, it's obviously not something that a lot of people in the U.S. pay attention to, but in Canada, there's a big push to move that stuff west and east. It's Enbridge, as I already mentioned, Enbridge for this, creating their own Keystone XL clone, sort of looking at moving it to the Gulf. But Enbridge is really active in trying to push a pipeline that goes westward in Canada. They're also TransCanada is active in trying to push a pipeline called the Energy East Pipeline that goes eastward. And so both companies mm-hmm. are active in the east-west movement of oil in Canada,
yeah.
the attempt to move it on the east-west. So yeah, that's important, really important stuff. And both also in the United States, looking at east-west, especially west, there's not really many mm-hmm. pipelines in the United States that go from Canada, especially Alberta, to the west coast. And so a main way of moving that oil is by rail.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Enbridge talked about in that same investor call, some of the Enbridge executives talked about how for a long time to come, the West Coast will be reliant on the rail to move that heavy
mm-hmm.
tar sands crude. And so that's another development in the industry.
Yeah. And they're looking at a port out in Maine, too. And they have trouble there because people voted it out, against it.
Yeah, that's the Line 9 pipeline, I believe.
Okay.
It's also an Enbridge pipeline. Yeah, Enbridge is, I think.
I was going to say, I think we can probably be sure that since they're going to be moving all this new, really incredibly dangerous dilbit, that they'll take extra precautions to make sure those pipelines have an integrity only dreamed of.
So TransCanada's pitch is definitely that. That was their kind of their main marketing pitch for the Gulf Coast pipeline, which is the southern half of the Keystone XL that was opened up for business earlier this year, and that's the same line they're using for the northern half. And we'll see. The Keystone 1, the phase 1 and 2 of that pipeline system for TransCanada, that spilled about 12 times in the first few years of its existence.
Mm.
So the jury is still out, but we'll see.
Let me ask you.
Talking to Shelby. Oh, go ahead.
The Koch brothers are involved in, you know, for our listeners, you know, the Koch brothers do have a big stake in there. And the
Koch brother, so they're one of the biggest leaseholders of the land on which the tar sands are extracted. Not originally, there was some reporting that they were the biggest, but then upon reflection, or some further analysis, they're probably like the third biggest, but still one of the in the top three of leaseholders of the tar sands. And so that's. I mean, I think that's why they would be behind. People say that's why they're in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline, but I would go further to say that's why they would be in favor of literally any pipeline because it means that their leases become more valuable.
Right, right. Yeah, these people are about not controlling 100% of a market. They're happy with controlling 51% of a bunch of markets, you know, if they can handle it.
That's the Koch business model in a nutshell. If you look, their assets really are so widespread and all over the place, but that's how they've gathered so much wealth over the past several decades and increasingly becoming wealthier.
Yeah, and one of the things that strikes me is, you know, is besides, you know, the grab for these resources. In terms of oil, but there's a land grab as well as a grab for water resources that is quite dangerous in itself.
Right, yeah, and so, you know, extracting the tar sands, it takes lots of water resources, to get it through a pipeline, to thin that bitumen, to turn it into diluted bitumen. And the same thing goes for fracking, too, with how much water it requires, and so, I mean, we're at the same time, you know, California is going through an epic drought. Places in the Middle East are going through epic droughts, and so, but that has to be told in the same story as these Enbridge pipelines that we're talking about, because it's not just news. I mean, I should have been more clear in my article. It's not just news, but the pipelines aren't news in and of themselves. It's the climate change context, but it's also things like water resources. And so look at the whole picture,
you know, Steve,
and it becomes pretty frightening.
Let me ask you a question. You know, we're coming up into an election season. Obviously, the electorate's going to be paying about as much attention as they ever do.
to these matters. Do you think that this, you know, the pipeline controversy, you know, the continued, basically, you know, the full-throated ignoring of climate issues, do you see that as becoming a major issue in this coming 2016 election?
Well, I fear that, well, maybe, I don't know about 2016, I fear that in, you know, the upcoming 2014 elections, that even a guy like Tom Steyer, who is a major funder of the Democratic Party and trying to get climate change as an issue that's an important electoral issue, even he has been sort of pushed aside by some of the Democratic Party establishment because he's been a little bit too aggressive on the issue, they would say, and a little bit too outspoken, and there's an article in Politico about, you know, him and his advocacy, and so I'm not too confident that it will become, you know, not as confident as him at least, that it will become a major issue, like a wedge issue that people will vote on in elections, and especially it won't become a wedge issue if the party establishment is just shoving it to the side and kind of telling him, not really helping. I mean, you know, Super PAC has not raised even close to as much money as he originally intended for it to.
Well, I'm sure that we can count on Mrs. Clinton to give peace a chance and also to support the greening of American economy, don't you think? No, I shouldn't ask a good reporter a good sarcastic question like that. Let me go back to more your area of focus. Steve, how long do you think it's going to be before we have a major spill from these new pipelines? Oh, looks like he got disconnected, and we'll bring him back. Steve.
I'm back. Yeah, I got disconnected. Great. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's
thought
okay.
The NSA had gotten the best of you.
Steve, I was going to ask you a pipeline question. You know,
yeah,
these things spill so much and so often, and it was the issue of the spills. You know, we've seen spills now in Minnesota, we've seen spills in Arkansas, we've seen spills and the government's been imposing more and more strictures on these matters. If you were to guess, how long do you think these things are going to have to be in play before we start to see a new spill from this Enbridge and the what we might call the stealth version of Keystone XL?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Enbridge is a company that is already responsible for the biggest oil spill in U.S. history for tar sands, at least. That was the one in Kalamazoo, Michigan, back in 2010 that took place just several months after the big BP offshore oil spill. And so since then, of course, there's been the major one down in Arkansas in Mayflower. It was an ExxonMobil pipeline, and that one just reopened recently. And so these things seem to happen every – major ones have, you know, historically have seemed to happen every 2 to 3 years. And so it's really – it always seems like it's about – kind of a ticking time bomb, and and because the punishment, to go back to why it happens over and over again, the costs of doing so are so low for the oil industry. They don't have to pay high fines. They usually get away with just having to pay, you know, several thousand dollars at the most. The EPA never really holds them accountable for what they're doing, and so it's just a cycle that repeats itself over and over and over again. And so even BP, you know, they had to pay more probably than any other oil company for a spill in the United States for the offshore oil spill. But they're back in business now in the Gulf Coast. The Obama administration gave them the green light to start operating again. And so when there's no real penalties for them, they literally see it as a cost of doing business. And if the cost of doing so and spilling is lower than the cost they may have to pay to make it safer, then it's just something that's bound to happen again and again and again.
Well, I remember being surprised, as odd, as jaded as I am about these matters, I still remember being shocked when they declared a no-fly zone over that spill in Arkansas, so I think we can imagine that that's a way of the future.
Yeah, well, I actually was the one who first found out about that no fly zone, and I think so.
Pulitzer.
But they did it over the Gulf too, didn't they?
They put a
ban over flying on, over that area. So,
exactly.
Because obviously flying over would hamper the investigation.
Yeah.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, because one of the things, and we talk about the big events, the big spills, but on a daily basis, isn't it true that we got leaks throughout those pipelines, over miles and different places, and they're not reported and it's kept out of view many times.
Yeah.
So that's a real problem.
You're talking about mostly with gas pipelines.
Yeah.
You're right. And so this is a major problem. It's been increasingly measured by scientists, especially the guys at Cornell University, Bob Howarth and Tony Ingrassia, and those two guys have measured leakage rates, I think, in pipelines of somewhere around, depending on the area, about 2 to 5% of the gas gets leaked. And so this is methane being leaked, and that methane is, of course, a potent greenhouse gas, more potent than carbon dioxide. In the first 20 years in the atmosphere, something like 86 times more potent in the first 20 years, and then over 100 years, it pretty much levels out. So it's akin to carbon dioxide being in the atmosphere. And so that's less publicized. It's less, I think it's not as scandalous. You don't really see it, but it's there, and it's there every day. And it's problematic for sure.
Well, of course, we're having a new pipeline built across Florida from the north to the south, even as we speak. Let me interrupt
for a second. What pipeline is that?
I don't recall the name of it. Do you know off the top of your head, Louise?
I don't know what they're calling it, but yeah, it's a pipeline. It's for all purposes a tricky Rick pipeline for the governor, but who has investment in it? And I think it's methane. It's methane that I think that they are going to move north-south across the peninsula.
Yeah, hold on. I'm searching for it right now. I did want to mention, I just got a message from the guest who was supposed to be with us during our 8 o'clock break. And he contacts me and tells me that he was called away to Ferguson to try to do some crowd control and to build some better race relations up there. So, Mohammed Malik, our wishes are with you. We hope that you can do something to help the good people of Missouri, I think it is, right? Missouri?
Right.
Ferguson's
yeah.
in Missouri? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He sends his regards and wishes and apologizes for not being with us. But we know that he's doing good work up there. What I see here is the new gas pipeline system. Let's see what they call it here. It's not giving us that detail there. Trail and Florida Southeast Connections. Sable Trail, they're calling it. The Sable Trail and Florida Southeast Connection. So, Stephen, we're looking forward to your expose on that in the near future. Look into your crystal ball, Steve. What issues do you think are coming up in the next couple of months on the whole fracking and pipeline front?
Oh man, that's a good question. I think I hate to sound cynical, but I don't think at least in the mainstream sort of punditry, none of these issues will be talked about that much because most of the coverage will be of the upcoming November elections.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what the industry is covering and sort of going back to the business press and in that world, big thing is what's happening in Mexico right now, south of the border.
Mm-hmm.
They just passed these reforms to open up the their oil industry to international companies, so mainly U.S.-based companies like ExxonMobil, not just U.S.,
mm-hmm.
just any big, all the oil majors are now They can be co-owners of fields and of assets, so it's not just Pemex. And so this is a huge development. It's not really getting talked about that much in most of the media.
I'm sure it's a real shot in the bank account for Mexican democracy.
Yeah. No, it's a very important development. I think that a couple of years from now, people will be wondering sort of how did this happen, and then it'll be talked about as a historical thing. You know, it's how it happened, sort of how fracking happened in the United States, kind of quietly, and not that many people paying attention. But then a few years later, everyone realized, oh, it was the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and it had all these loopholes, and it had all these clauses that were sweet giveaways to the oil and gas industry. And I think that's exactly what's happening right now in Mexico.
Yeah. And Dick Cheney's still not incarcerated. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen.
Yeah, and Halliburton. And Halliburton stands to gain.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight and helping my audience get a new understanding of these matters. I thank you so much. I want to tell you I appreciate both of you tremendously. You are an asset to the progressive community, and please keep up the good work. God knows we need it.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me, as always.
Okay.
Bye-bye,
guys.
Thanks, Rick.
Okay.
Take care.
You're welcome.
Take care.
I want to remind my audience there are many good progressive broadcasters out there. Susan Nylon, the Nylon Report, Sita Beguil, and the Sita Media. Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women. And please support these progressive broadcasters. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak of Progressive News Network. I tell you, you know, without your support, without your help, and the help of my good friends at Florida Media Labs, these shows couldn't continue. I hope you're listening, and I hope you'll tell your friends that there's work to be done. Don't forget, vote August 26th. Support the progressive candidate for governor, Nan Rich. And I know you've got your shoulder to the grindstone. So let's keep up the good work, friends.
Now come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, because the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know the teeth can only be one when the blowing while the kingdom comes. Sing it! 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for?
And that's for our friends, the good peace activists out there. We know you're with us. We know there's another war to protest, another rally to attend, and more politicians to educate. And now I'll leave you with this thought. And then we'll see this song come true.
We shall overcome. We shall.
We shall live in peace. first was made up down in Montgomery, Alabama, says we are not afraid. And here you and I up here, and like every human being in the world, we have been afraid. But you still sing it, we are not afraid. We are not afraid.
We are.